Welcome to the Deep Dive. We're here to cut through the noise, break down dense research, and give you the insights you actually need. Today, we're jumping into Southeast Asia, or seeing a real economic engine. We've got the latest Economy SCA 2025 report in front of us. This is the big one from Google, Temasek, and Bain.
Yeah, and it's quite something. This is the 10th year they've done this, and the report really confirms the region's hitting its stride. We're talking about the digital economy heading towards surpassing $300 billion in gross merchandise value by 2025.
$300 billion. Wow.
And get this, that number is 1.5 times what they originally forecast way back, a decade ago. So serious momentum.
That really speaks volumes about the digital transformation there. And look, for anyone thinking about where capital might flow next, this report actually broadens the view quite a bit. It's not just the usual CA6 markets. They've expanded to the full ASEAN 10. So yeah. Brunei, Cambodia, Laos, Myanmar are now in the mix too. Our job today, really, is to sift through all this data, this massive $300 billion picture, and find those key nuggets, especially for investors.
Absolutely. And the first thing that just jumps out is the sheer consistency of the growth.
Yeah.
You look at the core numbers, GMV, total revenue. The region's holding steady with double-digit growth.
Yeah.
Around, say, 15% year over year.
Okay, 15%.
And crucially, this isn't just, you know, a post-pandemic bounce. It's deeper. It's driven by more people participating digitally, sure, but also by platforms getting smarter about making money. Think higher pricing tiers, more sophisticated offerings, real monetization kicking in.
Okay, let's get into the money then, the private funding aspect. Yeah. Globally, things got tight for venture capital. What's the report saying about Southeast Asia? Is there a thaw?
There's a cautious uptick, I'd say. Private funding did grow about 15% in the last year,
mm-hmm.
Climbing from $6.8 billion to $7.7 billion.
So 15% growth. Is that a real recovery starting, or more like stabilization after the big dip we saw everywhere?
I think it's stabilization, but it's disciplined stabilization.
Yeah.
It definitely reflects a flight to quality. Investors aren't just, you know, spraying money at early stage ideas anymore.
Right.
The data is really clear on this. There's been a significant shift towards more mature companies. Roughly 80%, 80, of the total funding went into late-stage deals. We're talking Series C to E and beyond.
80%? Wow, that's a big jump from before.
It is, yeah. It was closer to 70% the year before. So VCs are clearly backing businesses with proven models, businesses that can show a clear path to scale, and frankly, ones that are already operating efficiently.
And it seems like one sector is just soaking up a huge amount of that late-stage cash, digital financial services, DFS, still the big magnet.
Oh, absolutely, undisputed. DFS pulled in somewhere between 45% and 50% of the total deal value over the last 12 months. That's a huge share.
Nearly half.
Yeah. Investors see that core infrastructure maturing, things like cross-border payments, these unified QR systems popping up everywhere. And they're betting on the platforms that can really leverage all that connectivity, the ones that can scale up lending, wealth management, insurance.
Right. And speaking of maturity, the focus seems to have shifted hard towards profitability, capital efficiency. We used to hear constantly about companies in the region just burning cash indefinitely. Is that changing? Are companies actually hitting profitability now, or is it still mostly talk?
The narrative and the reality, I think, has genuinely shifted. The report found that 80%, again, a high number, 80% of the early stage investors they talked to said most of their portfolio companies are either already profitable or they expect them to be within the next 12 months.
Wait, within the next year? For the majority of an early stage portfolio, that sounds incredibly optimistic. Is that just wishful thinking? Or is there evidence that the path to exit, like IPOs, is actually becoming clearer?
It sounds ambitious, I agree, but there are concrete signs backing it up. The report mentions a pretty healthy pipeline of over 150 potential IPO candidates across key markets like Indonesia, Malaysia, Singapore.
150 plus.
Yeah. Companies are getting more mature. They're focusing on the kind of solid fundamentals that public markets demand. Better unit economics, tighter operations. This makes them genuinely viable for listing, which in turn makes sense of why investors are focusing so much on those later stages.
Okay, so that paints a picture of, let's say, maturing stability at the macro level. Let's dive into some specific sectors. E-commerce is still the giant, right? Consolidation seems to be happening. But the thing that really jumped out at me from the source material was this explosion in video commerce.
Oh, it's huge. It's not just a side feature anymore. It's becoming a core channel.
Yeah.
Video commerce now makes up a staggering 25% of the total e-commerce GMV in the region.
25% just from video. What was it before?
Tiny. Less than 5% just back in 2022. So yeah, it's driving massive shifts in market share.
Okay, but here's the really interesting part for investors, I think. This massive growth isn't coming from people spending more per order. It's sheer volume, right? Transactions surged 50% year over year, but the average order value, the AOV, for these video commerce transactions is super low, like $6 or $7 an order, which is actually pulling the overall e-commerce AOV down. How does that low-value, high-frequency model make sense?
It makes sense because it taps into something fundamental about commerce in the region.
Mm.
It's very much about trust and, frankly, entertainment. Video's show-don't-tell aspect just cuts through purchase hesitation.
Right. You see it, you trust it more.
Precisely. See, a cosmetic actually being applied or clothes being modeled live, trust builds faster. And that low $6 and $7 price point, it makes it almost an impulse buy. Logistically, the game isn't about maximizing one big basket. It's about getting people to buy frequently, building stickiness.
Which explains why certain categories are just dominating video commerce. The report mentions beauty and personal care at 21% of the video GMV, and fashion and accessories at 27%. Those are perfect show-me categories.
Exactly. And think about the data that generates. All those frequent small transactions create a massive amount of first-party data, which actually segues nicely into another big trend.
Okay, lead on. Are we talking about food delivery finally making money?
We are. Those platforms that seemed like perpetual cash burners. The picture is shifting. Food delivery is moving from being a sort of discretionary treat to a more routine, accessible option for many.
Yeah.
And importantly, most major platforms are now either profitable or very close to it.
How? Weren't the delivery commissions always seen as prohibitively high, making profits impossible?
They tackled it from both ends, costs and revenue diversification. On the cost side, lots of work went into optimizing logistics, making deliveries more efficient, especially in cities.
Mm-hmm.
But the big lever is on the revenue side. They're boosting profits with adjacent high-margin income streams. Advertising is a big one, seeing high double-digit growth there, particularly from smaller long-tail restaurants who need the visibility the platform provides.
And they're also moving beyond just delivery, right? Trying to capture the dining-in market, too.
Yeah, that's a really smart move. Delivery commissions are tough, like you said, maybe 20, 25%. So platforms are thinking, how can we leverage our user base without the high cost of delivery?
Okay.
So they're offering services for in-restaurant dining. Think curated discovery, finding restaurants, or selling high-margin discount vouchers for eating in. It's leveraging the audience without the motorbike.
Clever.
Clever.
And sticking with high-margin revenue from user data. Retail media networks, RMNs, suddenly a $3 billion market. What exactly is driving that surge?
It's all about owning the customer relationship and the data that comes with it.
Mm-hmm.
An RMN basically lets brands buy ad space sponsored products, banner ads directly on the marketplace platform itself, like Shopee or Tokopedia or Lazada.
Right when you're about to buy something.
Exactly. High intent. Because the platform has all that first-party data on what you browse and buy, the ads can be incredibly targeted and effective for the brands and for the marketplace platform. It's a very lucrative, high-margin revenue stream built right on their core business.
Okay, let's pivot to the underlying pipes. Digital financial services, DFS, we know it's attracting investment. What does maturity actually look like on the ground beyond just payments?
Well, the payment infrastructure itself is now incredibly robust. Think about this. All 10 ASEAN countries now have their own national unified QR payment systems, like QRAS in Indonesia or Do It Now in Malaysia.
Right. Those are becoming ubiquitous.
And crucially, 8 of those markets now support regional cross-border QR payments between them. That kind of seamless connectivity is huge for trade, for tourism, for everything.
Okay, so payments are sorted. What else in DFS?
We're seeing real scale emerge beyond payments. Digital wealth platforms, for instance. They aren't niche anymore. Several now have over $1 billion in assets under management. They're competing hard with traditional banks, often with lower fees.
$1 billion AUM.
Okay. And things like embedded loans get offered right at the point of sale when you're buying something online or through an e-wallet. They seem to be performing well, mainly because they're just so convenient and integrated. Okay, makes sense. What about travel? We saw that huge revenge travel boom post-pandemic.
Mm.
Has that growth sustained or is it starting to level off?
It's still growing, but the reason for the growth has shifted a bit. A lot of the GMV increase now is actually down to higher prices, airfares, hotel rates, rather than just a massive surge in the number of trips.
Ah, so inflation is playing a big role.
Definitely. We've seen some significant price hikes stick. Hotel room rates in places like Singapore and Malaysia, for example, they've managed to raise them by 20, 25% compared to pre-pandemic levels. That bumps up the total market value considerably.
But that must be putting pressure on consumers, surely. How are people responding to paying more for travel?
They're adapting. The main change is prioritizing shorter, more regional trips. The data shows the average length for long-haul trips, those going outside the Asia-Pacific region, has actually dropped by about 1.3 days.
Interesting. So cost is definitely a factor. People still want to travel, but they're choosing closer destinations or shorter stays to manage the budget.
Exactly. It's a balancing act. And that ties into transport, too. Ride-hailing, etc. GMV and revenue there are growing. Is that also price-driven or something else happening?
It's partly price, but also platforms getting smarter with their strategies. Things like subscription bundles that offer discounts, more in-app advertising, and significantly dialing back on driver incentives and promotions.
The profitability focus again, cutting subsidies.
Right. Just like food delivery, they're focusing more on unit economics rather than just chasing growth at any cost. But the really interesting thing in transport, the potential game changer down the line, is autonomous vehicles, AVs.
The robo-taxis. Are they actually happening in Southeast Asia?
The pilots are certainly happening. They're underway in 6 countries across the region already.
6 countries, okay. And what's the timeline for this being a real disruption? Are we talking decades away?
Maybe not that long. The economics are potentially stark. The report suggests that robo-taxis could actually become cheaper to operate than human-driven taxis within, say, 3 to 5 years.
3 to 5 years? Really?
Yeah. That's based on projections of falling manufacturing costs for the vehicles. But maybe more importantly, the potential for much, much higher utilization rates compared to a human driver who needs brakes, sleep, and so on. If that pans out, it's a massive disruption looming.
Okay, that's a perfect transition to the really hot topic everywhere. Artificial intelligence, AI. The excitement seems global, but what's the picture in Southeast Asia?
Oh, the buzz is definitely there. The report identifies around 700 active AI startups in the region.
700.
And look at the funding flows. Roughly 30% of all private funding in the last 12 months went towards AI-related investments in one way or another.
30%? That's significant. And the VCs are bullish, too.
Very. 71% of the VCs surveyed expect that more than a quarter of their entire portfolio will have AI as a core product or feature within the next year.
Wow. Okay, so massive enthusiasm, lots of investment. But I sense a but coming.
There is a but. A specifically ASEAN AI paradox, you could call it. It comes down to the cost-value equation in this specific region. While users in Southeast Asia are actually global leaders in terms of interest, 75% say they use AI tools for discovery.
Okay, high user interest.
The actual business case for deploying AI, especially for automation, runs headfirst into the region's labor cost structure.
Explain that. In the West, a big driver for AI adoption is replacing expensive human labor. Why is Southeast Asia different?
It's the sheer scale of the difference in labor costs. Put simply, deploying sophisticated AI models is often still way more expensive than hiring people in Southeast Asia. Some key data from the report really highlights this. The weighted average wage in Southeast Asia is roughly 5%, just 5% of the U.S. average.
That's percent.
And about 36% of the average wage in China. So if your main business case for AI is just simple task automation replacing workers, the return on investment just doesn't stack up the same way it might in the US or Europe. It takes much longer or might not even be there for certain tasks.
Okay, that throws that 71% VC expectation into a different light, doesn't it? If the ROI for simple replacement is weak, where is that 30% of funding actually going? What's the smart AI play in the region?
The immediate imperative and where the smart money seems to be focusing isn't full replacement. It's augmentation.
Augmentation, meaning?
Meaning using AI to make existing workers more effective or tackling complex, high-value problems where AI speed or accuracy provides immediate leverage that outweighs the labor cost difference. Think sophisticated fraud detection systems, optimizing complex supply chains, or maybe giving a call center agent an AI co-pilot to help them handle difficult customer issues faster.
So targeting problems where the value add is much higher than just saving on wages for simple tasks.
Exactly. Problems where that 5% wage comparison becomes less relevant because the AI is doing something humans can't do as well or as quickly.
So the region isn't ignoring AI, but it's adapting the strategy. Is the underlying infrastructure being built to support this eventual AI boom, even if the immediate economics are different?
Oh, absolutely. The infrastructure build-out is massive. Planned data center capacity growth in Southeast Asia is actually set to lead the entire Asia-Pacific region. We're talking projected growth of around 180%.
Wow, 180% growth in data centers. Where is that happening?
It's being driven hard by huge demand, especially in markets like Malaysia. Singapore has traditionally been the hub, but it's hitting constraints, particularly around energy capacity for data centers. So Malaysia and other countries are seeing huge investment. This infrastructure is the critical long-term enabler, whatever the short-term labor economics look like.
Okay, so let's try and wrap this up for you, our listener. What have we seen? A region with really solid, sustained double-digit growth. We've seen late-stage investment capital becoming more disciplined, heavily favoring that maturing DFS infrastructure.
Right, and clear paths to profitability are finally emerging in sectors that burned cash for years, like food delivery, often through smart diversification like ads and retail media.
And then there's the AI frontier. Massive investment, huge user interest, but facing this unique cost-value paradox due to labor costs, pushing the focus towards augmentation over simple replacement for now.
Yeah, those are the key ingredients, I think. The dynamics shaping the next few years seem clear. It's about AI acceleration, certainly a renewal of focused investment, and hopefully greater cooperation across the ASEAN region.
But there's always a but, isn't there?
There is. The real wild card, the factor that you absolutely need to keep your eye on, is regulation.
The regulatory environment. Especially for something like AI, it must be incredibly complex across 10 different countries.
Exactly. AI governance, data privacy, cross-border data flows. It's all still pretty fragmented across ASEAN right now. There are efforts, like the ASEAN Guide on AI Governance, but it's early days.
So the final thought for you to chew on is this. Will the way these regulations evolve, fragmented or harmonized, ultimately unlock Southeast Asia's massive digital potential in this next phase? Or could regulatory friction actually inhibit it?
That's the multi-billion dollar question, isn't it? How those regulatory choices play out across the 10 unique markets will likely be the decisive factor in how fully that $300 billion digital economy and the next stage beyond it is realized. Something to definitely keep watching.